Part 2. Chapter 8. Yes, there had been mist, together with needle-sharp frost, hoary coniferous branches, and snow, dark, moonless snow, falling just before daybreak. Beyond the city, in the distance, the blue cupolas of churches dotted with tinsel-like stars were visible, while on the far Moscow bank of the Dnieper, the illuminated cross on the top of the statue of St. Vladimir rose high into the fathomless sky, shining until dawn. With daybreak, the light on the cross went out, and the stars disappeared. But the day didn't brighten up especially, threatening to become rather grey. The Ukraine was covered with a low-lying layer of impenetrable cloud. In the village of Popelyucha, some 8 miles from the city, Colonel Kozierleshko awoke exactly at daybreak, with the meagre light trickling like sour milk through the narrow little window of his hut. His awakening coincided with the word position. It seemed at first that the word had simply appeared, as if part of a warm dream while he was fast asleep. He had even tried to brush it aside with his hand, as if it were cold to the touch. But the word expanded and made its presence felt in the hut, together with the crumpled envelope and the revolting red pimples on the face of his batman. Taking his mica map case to the window, he pulled out a map, found the village of Borhuni, then Beli Hai, and started tracing with his fingernail along the network of roads dotted with little bushes on either side like flies, until he came to the huge black area denoting the city. In addition to the smell of the strong, cheap tobacco that Kozier himself smoked, the room was filled with the reek of strong, low-grade tobacco from the possessor of the red pimples, who was under the assumption not only that he could smoke in Kozier's presence, but also that he would not thereby be harming the war effort. Kozier was faced with the immediate prospect of going into battle. Reacting cheerfully to the idea, he gave a huge yawn and buckled on the intricate harness, slinging the straps over his shoulder. He had slept that night in his greatcoat, not even removing his spurs. A peasant woman came bustling in with a jug of milk, but Kozier never drank milk and wasn't about to start now. Some young children appeared from nowhere and started crawling about. One of them, the smallest with a completely naked behind, crawled along the shelf and clambered up to get hold of Kozier's Mauser. But before he could get to it, Kozier had already strapped it on. All his life up until 1914, Kozier had been a village teacher. In that year, he went to war with a regiment of dragoons, and by 1917, he had been commissioned. And now, at dawn on the 14th of December 1918, Kozier found himself to be a colonel in Petliura's army, and nobody in the world, least of all Kozier himself, could explain how this had happened. But it had happened because for him, Kozier, war was a vocation, whereas teaching had been a drawn-out and major mistake. This, however, can be a frequent occurrence in our lives. For 20 whole years, someone can be engaged in doing something or other, lecturing in Roman law, for example, and then suddenly, in the 21st year, it turns out that Roman law has become totally irrelevant, that it is a subject he neither understands nor likes, and that he is, in actual fact, a keen gardener with a passion for flowers. This happens, it might be supposed, because of the imperfections in the way in which society is organized, as a result of which people often find their true vocation only towards the end of their lives. Kozier found his at the age of 45. Before then, he had been a poor teacher, tedious and cruel to his pupils.
"Right, tell the lads to get outside and mount their horses,"
Kozier said in Ukrainian, tightening the creaking straps around his waist. Smoke was rising above the white huts of Popelyucha as Colonel Kozier's column of troops, about 400 sabers strong, rode out of the village. Wreaths of cheap tobacco smoke hung over the column, and Kozier's 15-hand bay stallion trotted nervously under him. The baggage wagons creaked along, strung out for a few hundred yards behind the column. The men swayed in their saddles, and as soon as the regiment was out of Popelyucha, they unfurled a two-coloured banner at the head of the column, one yellow strip and one blue strip attached to a pole. Kozier couldn't stand tea, preferring more than anything a measure of vodka in the morning. He loved imperial vodka, something that hadn't been around for 4 years, but that now, under the hetman, had become available throughout the Ukraine. The vodka poured from Kozir's grey flask and into his veins like a hot flame. It ran, too, through the veins of his men, poured from mess tins obtained from a store in Belaya Tsirkov, and once it had taken effect, a three-sectioned accordion struck up at the head of the column, and someone started singing in a falsetto voice, "Oh, the woods, the forests of green that stretch as far as the eye can see," the song being taken up by the basses in the fifth row. The young girl was ploughing the field with a strong black ox that refused to yield, and when the ox, oh the ox, went its own way, she asked a Cossack on his fiddle to play. The trooper carrying the banner started whistling happily like a nightingale and cracking his whip. Lances and black-braided and black-tasseled fur caps swayed along in time with the singing. Snow crunched under 1,000 iron-shod hooves. A tapping drum added to the general sense of merriment.
"That's it, lads! Keep your spirits up!"
Kozir shouted approvingly as the nightingale song soared up over the snow-covered Ukrainian fields. When they had passed through Belly High, the mist lifted. All the roads were black with troops, the snow crunching underfoot as they marched along. At a crossroads near High, they allowed a 1,500-strong group of infantrymen to go ahead of them. The men in the front ranks, all from Galicia, were wearing identical dark blue jerkins made from good-quality German cloth, and their faces were more refined and mobile than Kozir's troopers. The men towards the rear were wearing long hospital gowns reaching down to their ankles, with yellow leather belts tied round the waist. On their heads, bobbing above their fur caps, they all wore battered German helmets. Their metal-soled boots pounded the snow beneath them. All this activity had turned the snow on the roads leading to the city black.
"Hurrah!" cheered the infantrymen as they marched past the blue and yellow banner. "Hurrah!" echoed the woods around High.
The cheers were answered by gunfire on their left flank and to the rear. During the night, the commander of the besieging forces, Colonel Tarapietz, had sent two batteries to take up their positions in the city park. The snow-covered pine trees, tall and straight as masts, awoke to the thunderous sound of waves of 6-inch shells. Two rounds landed near the large settlement of Pushcha Vodica, shattering all the glass in the windows of 4 snowbound houses. Several pine trees were reduced to splinters, sending fountains of snow cascading many yards into the air. But then the gunfire in Pushcha died down. The forest stood there, once again half asleep. Only the alarmed squirrels scurried and clawed their way up and down the 100-year-old tree trunks. The two gun batteries were transferred from their position near Pushcha to the right flank. They moved across the seemingly endless ploughed fields, then through the wooded area around Yurochishche, and turned down a narrow path until they reached a fork in the road, where they stopped and deployed, now within sight of the city. Then, in the early hours of the morning, they started shelling Podgorodnaya, Savskaya, and the city suburb of Korenyovka with high-bursting shrapnel. In the low-lying snowy sky, there was a rattling sound, as if someone were playing on a musical instrument. The inhabitants had been sheltering in their cellars since early morning, and in the half-light of dawn, frozen groups of cadets could be seen making their way towards the center of the city. The gunfire, however, soon ceased, to be replaced by the animated crackle of small arms fire somewhere on the outskirts to the north of the city. Then that, too, fell silent. The train carrying the commander of the troops besieging the city, Colonel Tarapietz, stood at a small station somewhere deep in the forests, about 2 miles from the snowbound, deserted village of Sviatoshin, still reeling from the deafening crash and thunder of gunfire. Throughout the night, the electric light had been burning in all 6 carriages, and the station telephone, as well as the field telephones in Tarapietz's grimy compartment, had never stopped squawking. As soon as the snowy landscape outside had emerged into the full light of day, the guns farther up the line from Sviatoshin to Postvolinsky started thundering away, and the little birds in the yellow receivers burst into song once again.
"We've taken Sviatoshin,"
the thin, nervous Tarapietz informed his adjutant, Khudyakovsky.
"Find out, if you please, whether we can now move up to it."
Torrepiez's train slowly started to move between the walls of tall, snow-covered trees, stopping close to where the railway line was crossed by a major road that pointed like an arrow straight into the heart of the city. Here, in his compartment, Torrepiez began to carry out the plan that he had devised over 2 sleepless nights in this self-same bug-ridden carriage, number 4173. Shrouded in mist, the city was surrounded on all sides. To the north, forest and ploughed fields. To the west, the captured village of Sviatoshin. To the southwest, the ill-fated Postvolinsky. And to the south, where the railway line bordered the woods, there were cemeteries, pastures, and a shooting range. And there was cavalry on the move everywhere, the horses' harnesses jingling as they crept in a black tide along the tracks and railway lines, or advanced unhindered across the snowy plains. The heavy gun carts creaked, while Petliura's infantry, worn out by a whole month of hanging about in reserve, became bogged down in the snow. In the apartment of Torrepiez's train, with its scuffed cloth floor, the telephone trilled incessantly, and the operators Franco and Harris, not having had a wink's sleep all night, began to fool about, making silly noises over the phone. Torrepiez's plan was a cunning one, just as he himself, the black-browed, clean-shaven, nervous Colonel Torrepiez, was a cunning man. It was not for nothing that he had posted 2 gun batteries close to the city's forest, nor was it for nothing that his shells had crashed through the frosty air to destroy the tramline in the shabby village of Pushcha Voditsa. Neither was it a coincidence that he had then moved his machine guns across from the ploughed fields to a position where they would be closer to the army's left flank. Torrepiez wanted to pull the wool across the eyes of those defending the city by pretending that he would be taking the city from the springboard of his, Torrepiez's, left flank, that is, from the north, and from the suburb of Kurinyovka, thereby drawing their army over in that direction. In actual fact, however, he would be striking right at the heart of the city by moving directly from Sviatoshin along the Brest-Litovsk highway, as well as by thrusting forward from the extreme right flank in the south, from the village of Demyevka. And so, in accordance with Torrepiez's plan, elements of Petliura's army, moving along the roads, made their way across from the left flank to the right. Among them were the black-capped troopers of Kozielyeshka's regiment, marching with the NCOs in the lead, to the accompaniment of pipes and accordion. "Hurrah!" echoed the woods around high. "Hurrah!" Advancing, they left high behind them and crossed the railway line by a wooden bridge, where they came within sight of the city. The city was still warm from sleep, and the sky was wreathed either in mist or smoke. Standing up on his stirrups and looking through his Zeiss binoculars, Kozier could see the roofs of the huge multi-story buildings and the cupola of the ancient St. Sophia Cathedral. On Kozier's right flank, fighting was already underway. Less than a mile away, he could hear the metallic crash of heavy guns and the rattle of machine gun fire. Detachments of Petliura's infantry could be seen dashing across in the direction of Postvolinsky, while uncoordinated and assorted detachments of White Guard infantry, stunned by the intense shelling, were falling back from Post. The city. Low, cloud-covered sky. A street corner. Houses to one side. The occasional greatcoat. "It's just been announced that there's been some sort of agreement with Petliura to allow all armed Russian troops to leave the city and joined Denikin on the Don." "Well, and?" The crash and thunder of gunfire. The whine of a machine gun. Despairing, baffled cadet's voice. "But doesn't that mean we'll have to stop resisting?" Despondent cadet's voice. "Who the devil knows?" Colonel Shchetkin hadn't been at army headquarters that morning, for the very simple reason that the headquarters no longer existed. On the night of the 14th of December, it had left for City Passenger Railway Station No. 1, spending the night at the Hotel Rose of Stamboul, right next to the telegraph office. There, Shchetkin's telephone had trilled once or twice during the night, but by morning it had fallen silent. And that morning, 2 of Colonel Shchetkin's adjutants vanished without trace. An hour later, after rummaging around in boxes full of papers and tearing some documents into shreds, Shchetkin himself left the grubby Rose, no longer in his grey greatcoat with epaulettes, but in a civilian fur coat and a pork pie hat. Where they had come from, no one had any idea. Taking a cab one block away from the Rose, Shchetkin went to a small but well-furnished apartment in Lipki, rang the bell, kissed a generously proportioned golden-haired woman, and retired with her to a secluded bedroom. Her eyes widened in shock as he looked directly into them and whispered,
"That's it. It's all over."
"I'm exhausted," he said, and went behind an alcove where he fell asleep after drinking a cup of black coffee prepared for him by the hands of the golden-haired lady. The cadets of the 1st Infantry Detachment knew nothing about any of this, and this was a pity. Had they known, their desire to fight would have been diminished, and instead of stumbling about under a shrapnel-torn sky at Postvolinsky, they would have made their way to that cozy little apartment in Lipki, seized Colonel Shchetkin, dragged him outside, and hanged him from the nearest lamppost right opposite the golden-haired woman's apartment. Had they done this, it would have been really good. But they didn't do it, because they didn't know or understand anything that was going on. And indeed, nobody understood anything about what was happening in the city, and it was quite likely that it would be a long time before anyone did understand. There were still some metal-helmeted Germans in the city, although it is true they were somewhat demoralized. Maybe the foxy Hetman, too, with his trimmed moustache, was still there. Only very few people knew about the wounding of the mysterious Major von Schratt in the neck that morning. Possibly also His Excellency Prince Bielorukov and General Kartusov, responsible for setting up detachments charged with the defense of the mother of Russian cities. The headquarters telephones were still trilling, although nobody was yet aware that since early morning these very same headquarters had begun to melt away. In general, however, the city was full of military men. There was real anger in the city whenever Petliura's name was mentioned, and he was still being mocked by dissolute St. Petersburg journalists in that morning's edition of the News. While cadets were walking around inside the city, out there in the suburbs, the whistle of Petliura's approaching black-capped cavalry could already be heard, together with the high-spirited Ukrainian Cossacks, as they moved jauntily across from the army's left flank to the right. And if their whistling could be heard only a couple of miles away, then what hope was there for the Hetman? And the whistling meant they were coming to get him. Maybe the Germans would come to his rescue. But then, why were those stolid Germans just sitting around at Fastov Station, grinning apathetically into their clipped German moustaches as unit after unit of Petliura's army passed them on their way to the city? Perhaps there had been some agreement with Petliura to allow him to enter the city peacefully. But if so, why the hell should the white officer's guns still be firing at him? No, nobody will ever understand what was going on in the city during the afternoon of the 14th of December. The headquarters telephones were still trilling away, albeit, it is true, less and less often. Less often. Now, only occasionally. Ring. What's going on? Ring. More ammunition to Colonel Stepanov, Ivanov, Antonov, Stratonov. We should go to the Don, lads, immediately. Nothing's going right here, damn it. Ring. To hell with those bastards at HQ. To the Don. The telephones rang less and less often. By midday, they had all but stopped. All around the city, now in one place, now in another, there was the intermittent thunder of gunfire. But despite all the noise, life in the city at midday continued much as normal. The shops were open and trading as usual. The pavements were filled with a mass of scurrying pedestrians. Doors slammed, and the trams continued to run along the streets, their bells ringing. But then, at midday, there was a lively burst of machine gun fire from the Pyacersk region of the city. The Pyacersk hills echoed to the staccato rattle that could be heard as far away as the city center. My goodness, that was a bit close, wasn't it? What's going on? Passers-by stopped and began to sniff the air. Immediately, there were noticeably fewer people on some of the pavements. What? Who? Rat-a-tat. Rat-a-tat-tat. At-a-tat. Ta-ta. Who's that firing, then? What do you mean, who? Don't you know? That's Colonel Bolbotun. So, he'd rebelled against Petliura, had he? Tired of attempting to carry out Colonel Tarapietse's complicated staff plan, Colonel Bolbotun had decided to speed things up. His cavalry had been frozen, just hanging around behind the cemetery in the very south of the city, where it was only a stone's throw to the wise, ancient, snow-covered Dnieper. And Bolbotun had been frozen too, so with a flourish of his whip, he had sent his regiment moving off in threes, spreading out along the road and onto the railway line, hugging the edge of the city. Here, Bolbotun met with no resistance. Six of his machine guns started firing with such force that the sound crashed like thunder around the entire low-lying wooded area near Nizhnaya Telichka. In a flash, Bolbotun cut off the railway line, halting a passenger train which had just crossed the bridge over the Dnieper, bringing a fresh consignment of Muscovites and Petersburgers with their chic women and long-haired dogs. Everyone went crazy with fear, but just at that moment, Bolbotun was too busy to be concerned with dogs. Accompanied by the whistle of shunting engines, the alarmed empty goods wagons moved from the freight depot to the passenger station, and Bolbotun's men sent a hail of bullets crashing onto the roofs of houses on Sviatotroitskaya Street. Bolbotun continued on into the city and along the street, making unimpeded progress as far as the military academy, where he sent his cavalry on ahead to scout along every little alleyway. It wasn't until he reached the peeling columns of the Nikolaev Academy that he came up against his first opposition. Here, he was met by machine gun and ragged rifle fire from isolated units. One of the Cossacks in the forward troop of the leading squadron, Butsenko, was killed. Five men were wounded, and two horses had their legs shattered. As a result, Bolbotun's progress was for a time delayed. He imagined, mistakenly, that he was confronted by unknown numbers of the enemy, whereas in actual fact, the blue-capped colonel was faced by only 30 cadets, with four officers and one machine gun. Bolbotun quickly ordered his columns to dismount, take cover, and return the cadets' fire. The whole Pyacharsk region was filled with the sound of gunfire echoing along the walls of the buildings. In the area of Millionaya Street, everything came rapidly to the boil. The effect of Bolbotun's incursion into the city was immediate. The metal shutters in the shops lining Yelisavetinskaya, Vinogradnaya, and Levashovskaya streets came crashing down. The brightly lit shop windows went dark, and the pavements immediately emptied, becoming strangely resonant. Caretakers hastily closed gates. The effect of Bolbotun's advance was also felt in the city center. The trilling of the field telephones at army headquarters began to fall silent. A gun battery telephones its headquarters. No answer, damn it. An infantry detachment telephones its commanding officer and manages to get through to someone, but the voice at the other end just mutters some incoherent nonsense.
Are your officers still wearing epaulettes?
What's that?
Ring, ring. Send a detachment to Pyacharsk immediately. What's that? Ring.
The name Bolbotun crept from street to street. Bolbotun. Bolbotun. How did people know that it was definitely Bolbotun and not someone else? The answer was not clear, but there was no doubt that people knew. Perhaps they knew it was Bolbotun because from midday onwards certain people wearing coats with lambskin collars began to mix with pedestrians and the usual city types lounging around. These people were everywhere, darting in and out of the crowd. They would fix cadets and gold-braided officers with long, lingering stares and begin to whisper. Bolbotun's in town, they would say, without any note of sadness in their voice. On the contrary, their eyes showed just how happy they were at the idea. Hurrah, they seemed to be saying.
Hurrah,
came the echo from the hills around Pyacharsk. This was the signal for all kinds of nonsense.
Bolbotun is Grand Prince Mikhail Alexandrovich.
Not at all. Bolbotun is actually Grand Prince Nikolai Nikolaevich.
No, Bolbotun's simply Bolbotun.
There'll be a Jewish pogrom.
No, there won't. Just the opposite. They're wearing red ribbons.
We better get home quickly.
Bolbotun is against Petlura.
No, he's not. He's for the Bolsheviks.
Quite the opposite. He's for the Tsar, but without any officers.
The Hetman's gone, hasn't he?
Surely not.
Really?
Really?
Ring, ring.
A Bolbotun reconnaissance group led by Cossack Lieutenant Galanba was trotting down a totally empty Millionaire Street. Then, suddenly, can you imagine it? A door opens, and none other than the famous army contractor Yakov Grigorievich Feldman comes dashing out and makes straight for the five mounted Cossack troopers. Have you taken leave of your senses, Yakov Grigorievich, that you should even think it necessary to come running out at such a time when such things are going on? And certainly, Yakov Grigorievich had the expression of someone who has taken leave of his senses. His hat had toppled onto the back of his head, his coat was unbuttoned, and his eyes were rolling all over the place. Yakov Grigorievich Feldman had good cause to go out of his mind. The moment the gunfire had started in the vicinity of the military academy, he had heard a groan coming from his wife's lovely little bedroom. Another groan followed. Then silence.
Oy vey, Yakov Grigorievich said in response to the groan.
He looked out of the window and convinced himself that things were not good at all. Nothing but empty streets and gunfire. But then the groaning increased in volume, cutting through his heart like a knife. His round-shouldered old mother poked her head round the bedroom door and shouted,
Yasha, it's begun, do you understand?
And Yakov Grigorievich's thoughts focused immediately on one place. The corner house at the very end of Millionaire Street, next to the patch of waste ground, where there was a small, rusty sign announcing in gold letters, Midwife, E.T. Shadurskaya. Although Millionaire Street wasn't a major road, it wasn't particularly safe. People were firing along it from Pyachersk Square towards the upper part of the city.
Just make it there. That's all he wants to do.
With his hat on the back of his head, his eyes bulging with terror, Yakov Grigorievich Feldman slinks along the wall.
Halt! Where do you think you're going?
Galanba leant down from his saddle. Feldman stood there, his face black as thunder, his eyes rolling, as he noticed the green Cossack ribbons on their caps.
I'm just a peaceful citizen, sir. My wife's giving birth, and I need the midwife. The midwife, you say? So why are you skulking about by the wall, eh, you horrible little yid?
Sir, I...
Feldman felt the sergeant's whip curl like a snake round his fur collar and his neck. He screamed out from the hellish pain, and his face, no longer black as thunder, turned white. As he stared at the Cossack's tassels, he had a sudden mental image of his wife.
Papers!
Feldman pulled out his document wallet, opened it, and took out the first piece of paper. But as soon as he had done so, he started trembling. He'd suddenly remembered something.
Oh, God. Oh, God, what had he done? Why on earth had he taken out that piece of paper? But how could he possibly be worried about such trivial matters while dashing out of the house with his wife in labor? Oh, woe to Feldman.
Sergeant Galanba grabbed at the document immediately. It was just a small piece of paper with a stamp. But for Feldman, it meant death. The holder of this pass, Yakov Grigorievich Feldman, is hereby permitted to enter and leave the city freely for the purposes of supplying the armored units of the city garrison with equipment and to move freely about the city after 12 midnight. Signed, Quartermaster General Major General Ilarionov, Adjutant Lieutenant Leschinsky. Feldman's job was to supply General Kartusov with lard, together with petroleum jelly for greasing his artillery pieces.
Please, God, let there be a miracle.
But, sir, that's the wrong document. Please.
No, it's the right document, said Galanba, grinning evilly. Don't worry, we can read it for ourselves.
Please, God, let there be a miracle. You can have 11,000 rubles, take it all, but just let me live, just let me live. Shema Yisrael.
But no miracle was forthcoming, and it was as well for Feldman that he died an easy death. Sergeant Galanba had no time to waste, and so, with just a single downward sweep of his saber, he sliced through Feldman's head.